This is an ESO and Dude Letter production. Welcome to Mission Briefing. Well, hello there. Thanks for tuning in. I don't know why this one sounds particularly sexy, but, you know, there you go. So, I am impressed by your decision to tune in to this episode. You might be wondering why I would compliment you for listening to my voice. Isn't each week reward enough? Well, surely it is, but this week we watched, and you'll listen to us talk about probably the most maligned Bond movie, at least in a very, very long time. The Quantum of Solace. This movie is way too much of a Bourne movie, a little bit baffling, kind of bizarre, but it has some truly charming moments. In fact, some of the few rare human moments in Bond history. So sit back and relax and enjoy Mission Briefing as we watch A Quantum of Solace. I guess Quantum of Solace? Solace. Let's go with Solace. A Quantum of Solace.
I'm Tony Heat.
And we're going to watch every episode of Doctor Who and then talk to you about it.
Every episode?
Every single one.
In order?
From an unearthly child to, you know, the future. And we're going to do it in a podcast that we call
The Watchathon of Rassilon.
WatchYourRassilon.com. And we're also a part of the ESO Network. So check us out or whatever.
Please.
Stay Rassil Awesome.
Stop trying to make Rassil Awesome a thing.
Nope.
Welcome to Mission Briefing. This week we watched early 2000s. I didn't look up the year. Early 2000s Bond movie, The Quantum of Solace, the only direct sequel to a Bond movie I can think of, and quite possibly the most pretentious title of a Bond movie ever. And that's kind of all I've got.
This is 2008, by the way, for you keeping score.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
My field notes, I realize I wrote down a whole bunch of stuff, but it's mostly sarcastic.
It's almost 2020. Like, we can round that down. It's early 2000s. So you were right on the money.
This really is like 9 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I saw it in theaters, too, because I loved Casino Royale.
Oh, on the Blu-ray, if that's like 9 years old at this point, that was one of the times they had trailers for upcoming movies.
That you couldn't avoid.
And oh my god, that really dated the movie. I'm trying to remember what one of them was.
Oh, I saw them, and I have the Bond box set, and the rest of them go directly into this kind of standardized thing. This one didn't, and I was kind of confused, as though someone just took it out of another DVD case and put it in this, but whatever. You've already heard both voices. This week on our Bond panel, I am Nick Hoffman, your host, your God Emperor of Myopia Podcast and Dude Letter. And on panel we have...
Hello, this is Daniel.
And this is Steve-O. Did not get lost during the break. We're all here, all three of us.
We did it. So we survived.
Let's get into it, guys.
So, as is tradition, we should talk a little bit about this cold open. We're introduced to a Batmobile introduction from Batman the movie, where we see the side panels of the car, a glorious side shot, and we're introduced immediately to the biggest mistake ever. Now, we've talked about how Bond movies often, for a while in the 90s especially, were not the best Bond movies, right? Other action franchises had ripped off Bond things, the guy who knows things, the spy kind... And so Daniel Craig was really trying to reclaim Bond elements, right? Unfortunately, the one that they learned from the most here is Jason Bourne. And the Bourne movies are nauseating. And so we get like a cut of a side panel, a cut of some guys with guns, a cut of the Alfa Romeo logo, a cut of the Aston logo. It's unwatchable, and I'm already have a headache just thinking about it.
It was everywhere. It was a mess. It definitely set the tone. But honestly, they were consistent. That was the tone. I mean, it wasn't my thing, but it was there and it was everywhere.
And it was nauseating. I mean, I know I sound like an old person when I'm talking about this, but like, again, recently we talked about the death of Roger Moore, of course. Watching The Spy Who Loved Me, his fights with Jaws are kind of like he throws something at Jaws. Yes. Nothing happens to Jaws. Then Jaws just kind of reaches out with both hands like he's Frankenstein's monster. Like, these fights are so...
Rips doors off their hinges.
They're so slow you can have a sandwich in between each punch.
These were great fight scenes, though, because everything is so well choreographed these days that it's almost completely unbelievable. Those fights were very genuine. It was like, there's no stunt doubles. Just get in there and rip shit apart, man. Like, and if you fuck up, then, like, you know, it's going to be fine. You're a monster and you're intimidating. And that's really how those fight scenes felt.
I mean, you're not wrong. And frankly, like, again, watching this, we know that Bond, especially Daniel Craig's Bond, is cribbing a lot of notes from The Dark Knight. You know, like, he's the anti-hero. In fact, half this movie, M's trying to rein him in while at the same time holding off the CIA so he can save the day still. But, like, this driving sequence is incredible because there's guys behind him with automatic weapons. They blow out the tires of, like, a truck, which hits the sidewall, which causes its... like its bumper to stick out, which then it swerves and impales Bond's car, so he does a T-turn, which tears off the side the door, which has been impaled, which leaves Bond exposed. Like, this is insane.
And there's a dude in the trunk the entire time that doesn't have a
Mr.
scratch White. On him at the end.
Yeah, he's fine.
Yeah.
He's a plot device. He's got to be fine.
Yeah, there you go.
So, the guy who directed this, did you guys look him up? Did you see what else he had directed?
Because he was the guy that did Atonement, right?
He was one of the producers and writers on Atonement. He directed World War Z after this, but before this, what he was known for was Stranger Than Fiction and The Kite Runner and Finding Neverland and Monsters Ball.
That's what it was, Finding Neverland.
He's directed Think Pieces.
He directed almost nothing after this, by the way.
No, he directed like one other movie after this worth mentioning. It was also written by Paul Haggis, of all people.
He wrote Casino Royale too, didn't he, Paul Haggis?
He did. But he also directed Crash, so there you go.
Well, directed Crash. Nobody really directed Crash.
Crash was, it was like a car accident.
Too common.
All right, so it turns out that the whole time after Bond vanquishes the cars and the bad guys vanquish the Carbonari, right, we're revealed that we're in Siena, Italy, and like Daniel said, in the trunk is a guy with... like kind of this huge scarred nose that has been in the trunk the whole time, and that he is kind of thrown out of the trunk, and then we get brought into a theme song, which was co-written by Jack White and Alicia Keys, tag team duo. Yeah.
This is a collaboration that had been in the making for decades, I think.
Yeah.
And it just happened to bubble up into a Bond film. There's no reason for it. It was a decent segue, I think, from Casino Royale. Like, it set the tone for me, but it was kind of forgettable.
I don't know. I mean, usually the way I can tell if a Bond film is going to be good or bad is by how good the theme is. The one exception to this is A View to a Kill, because that song rocks, but the movie's terrible. And this one just kind of summarized the Bond film for me. It's just sort of, oh, that's nice. I could picture listening to this on the radio and immediately forgetting it ever played, which is kind of how the film worked for me, too. It was just sort of... existed.
I mean, like most early to mid 90s Jack White songs, effectively.
Yes.
After the White Stripes was gone, before he figured out the 13 other bands he's in, the Recon Tours, all them. I don't know. It's a fine song. The problem is, to me, really, it's the Madonna problem, where even if it's a catchy song, and that Madonna song was literally everywhere, it just doesn't feel like a Bond theme, other than the fact that they incorporate the riff at the beginning. However, I will say the rest of the music in this Bond movie is pretty damn good. David Arnold's back, so the Bond theme is everywhere. I mean, and he completely ignores the Jack White song. He doesn't even bother incorporating that shit into anything.
Did David Arnold help write the theme, though?
Well, David Arnold has done it another 100,000 times. But he goes away. They must get mad at him, and he comes back, and then they do it again. But he's done it, I think, at least a dozen more times. But he's very good, at least, at incorporating the Bond theme over and over again. Let me pull up his list, because why not? He apparently also did the music for Hot Fuzz.
Oh, that's awesome right there.
You know, I'm complimenting him. He also did Die Another Day, so I apologize. He did Tomorrow Never Dies. He did Golden Eye. That crap. Anyway, he's done it a lot, and it's appreciated that he did the theme again. However, we should kind of get into this a little bit. Daniel, would you give us the plot?
Let me check the old wiki real quick, because that's the only way I could follow what was happening.
Oh my god, you're not kidding.
So, it's meant to be a direct sequel to Casino Royale, where Bond's trying to figure out who exactly Mr. White and Le Chiffre were working for, and he... After interrogating Mr. White, who somehow escapes because of an MI6 double agent, finds out that he's connected to this guy named Dominic Green, who's been buying huge swaths of land all over the world in order to control the world's water supply. Mm-hmm. And this guy named, I said Dominic Green, looks exactly like Roman Polanski, which is how I could really tell he was the villain. So eventually what he's trying to do is...
Well, he's selling a girl for rape, so, I mean...
He's a good guy.
You're not wrong with the Roman, yeah.
Well, he's trying to stage a coup in Bolivia so he could take over some desert land there and get the massive water source that's underneath it. And that's our Bond villain, ladies and gentlemen. He's not trying to destroy the world. He's just trying to get some water out of Bolivia.
He's going
to
monopolize water. Yeah. So really, Nestle's already beaten this guy to his evil plan. But
he's the Immortan Joe of Bond villains, really.
Yeah. And I mean, again, for all the bleakness that we're going to talk about and joke about, that's the difference between this one and some of the older Bond movies. Like, the whole time MI6 is assuming that it's an oil thing, which is already kind of like very real to power, very dark. They even reference it in some of the Tim Dalton movies, right? But this is like, we're running out of water, our most valuable resource, and you're just like, is this the day after tomorrow? Did I wander into Roland Emmerich or something?
Well, I know that there is some issues where that actually happens with, like, Nestle and Coca-Cola buying a whole bunch of water from areas that don't have it and then essentially not reimbursing the water that they took out. But at the same time, it's just a sort of Jean Le Carre sort of thing where it's, like, really subtle.
Well, and again, with two movies
Bond
ago...
Bond is not subtle.
Two movies ago, we were talking about someone buying up conflict diamonds instead of blood diamonds to make a space laser. A space laser, guys, come on. Like, that's something.
For the second time, right? There's a space laser.
Laboratory crafted diamonds will not suffice for this laser. It needs to be infused with the blood.
African blood is the only way you can make sure it's a true death laser.
That's right.
It's like some teenage kids doing like a satanic ritual, quote unquote.
Oh, that'd be a great Bond villain. Somebody who's a Satan and is trying to open up a portal to hell in Kazakhstan.
Well, I mean, it's like, at least Live and Let Die, there are zombies, right?
Yeah.
Kind of. Like, that would be something.
That's kind of what was missing in this movie for me. There was this big, overly convoluted plan to do something.
Yeah.
But no evil lair, no, like, over-the-top, just pure evil shenanigans.
Yeah.
It was a very honest...
Well, but and speaking to blood diamonds, there's a lot of weird distant shots of Bond walking through the desert with the future, like, with the Bolivian secret agent, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's just like, and then people trying to get water out of a spigot and there's no water. And it's just like, again, what movie did I wander into? Which is fine. Bond can be a social fighter of some sort or another. But it's so out of left field if this is literally a Rampage movie. Mm-hmm. So, it's no surprise that if you're listening to this one, God bless you, because, I mean...
Well, the weird thing is that Casino Royale set up a Rampage movie as the next one, and this really kind of forgot that after Mr. White escaped.
Well, the only one who remembers that is M, who keeps reminding us that, Bond, you should stop killing people. But Bond, honestly, isn't killing most of these people on purpose, for the most part.
Yeah.
Like,
and for somebody who's supposed to be a rogue agent, M really doesn't care. A whole lot.
Well, I mean, and again, number two is we're talking about a scenario in which the world is about to burn, and Bond is literally on the cusp of one of the biggest terrorist minds of the generation. He's literally on the level of a Goldfinger, where he's going to destroy the gold supply of the world and then be the only person with wealth left. And yet, it's all like, now, Bond, stop killing people.
Oh, Bond, you scamp. You put a bullet through another man's skull.
Or you... Now, one guy, he breaks his neck in Haiti.
Yeah.
You're starting to describe, like, an episode of Archer, but I'd much rather watch that.
Well, I mean, speaking of, when Archer goes into Rampage mode, he just literally goes into Rampage mode.
I'm pretty sure he's yelled Rampage several times.
I'm sure he has.
All right, so let's catch up the plot. After we end up in this... After we leave Jack White and Alicia Keys, with the kind of sand metaphor throughout, right?
Mm-hmm.
We end up with the double agent turning, And we find out that M's bodyguard all along has been working for an agency that we don't know yet, which is a really
Everybody says they have people everywhere. The floors say that. Nobody actually means it. Actual dialogue from this movie.
Which is a good line, actually, frankly. I also like how Mr. White's Scottish accent comes and goes throughout. A lot of the accents they don't commit to, but Mr. White especially goes all out. Man, my handwriting was drunk last night. M ends up getting a shot as she jumps out the way, right? But we kind of cut to London. They're doing a debrief of her agent after, again, like the ninth chase scene we've already had in this movie somehow.
So many chase scenes.
They end up in a like a renovated cathedral, and Bond's leg gets tied up in the ropes of the thing, and he ends up shooting the guy somehow through the head in what is arguably a very good film shot, right? Because Bond is tangled up, he pulls himself up, he reaches up with a gun, and all we see is his very intense expression as he shoots a man through the head, right? Which is kind of cool.
Yeah, that was actually a good shot because there's like several passes where he's swinging around trying to reach the gun and misses it, so there actually was tension.
I'll give the movie that. Like, I mean, I think you said it first. If you took out just the action sequences, there's some good action sequences in it, but that does not, a movie make, let alone a Bond movie
make? It doesn't
make
a Bond movie. Yeah, it really doesn't.
There's, like, no gadgetry, really?
There's
they
no
don't even
gadgetry.
Mention Q at all, or
they
Q
don't.
Branch.
That pissed me off. That's actually my big, I've got a bullet point here that just says, like, there are no gadgets. Where are the Bond quips? This is not a Bond movie.
He
is
had really? A Bond quip. He had a Bond kit quip.
Do you have it? Because I don't.
Yes. Right after in Haiti, he killed that guy, and M contacts him and asks, well, what happened to him? Bond just says, he was a dead end.
That's true. I'll give you that one. But I will say, like, this is one of the few where, like, he's running over building tops, he's in Siena, he's diving from and, like, nothing. Mm-hmm. This is where Roger Moore would be like, that was it. He's right on time as he crashed to that watch face or whatever it was, and nothing.
There is one very Roger Moore scene.
Yeah.
You remember the scene with the hotels? They arrive in Bolivia, and you know they're like, "Well, we're teachers on leave. Like, we gotta be in this shitty
lottery
hotel, right?" And then they go to the nicer hotel, and it's like, "No, we're teachers on leave, but we won the lottery." That was a very
Roger Moore scene.
Well, and then later on, when MI6 is after him and he beats them all up in the elevator, he gets away by kind of jumping onto the railing, walking along the railing, and then jumping back over the railing. And I'm like, that's kind of cute. Anyway, so we end up in Haiti, right? Because there's this kind of scene, he figures out that one of the only leads is this guy in Haiti. After the, I guess technically the only gadgetry we see, which is that they put the $20 bill on a table, and then the table turns into something out of Minority Report.
Yeah.
And they're just kind of sliding things around. And
now,
then
what exactly did they find out with that bill? Is it something that it was from some money that Lechiffre had laundered?
All right. So if you're ready for this level of bullshit, he had, like, a total of like $100 in his wallet in like US dollars, like $100 in pounds. They list it all out, like $60 in euros, whatever. Mm-hmm. They traced all the money, and of the money, sorry guys, this is literally what they say.
Yeah.
That the that one of the $20 bills that he had was linked to the money that they had tagged that they had given to Lechiffre, which was part of a sequence that was then deposited into a bank account that was in Haiti. And that was enough to send Bond to Haiti. Right? Does that sound familiar? Something?
Sure.
Everyone shaking their head.
Why
that's
not?
The best I got.
He got it from the CVS clerk. I don't know.
Yeah.
But this was, that was M's line. M's like, I bet you I have a tenner that he handled by the rate he handled money. He goes, yes, but I have more things to say. And then
the movie
advanced, kind of.
Well, I was just like, I was kind of with M at this scene where they're pulling this up and M's just like, okay, impress me. Yeah. Like, yes, please do, movie.
Mm-hmm.
But then essentially we have this moment where Bond finds out that the guy is staying in room 3-something in this hotel in Haiti, which is the only hotel in Haiti.
Worthy of Bond.
Well, that's rude.
But he kind of picks the lock, looks around the room, and this guy is just hiding off camera. There's a fight scene where he gets shoved through a bunch of orange glass, gets the hell cut out of him, snaps the guy's neck, because that's what Bond just kind of does.
Yeah, it was pretty brutal, actually.
This is before the opera performance, right?
This is before the opera performance.
Yeah.
Because he has some pretty brutal kills in this movie overall.
Yeah.
But the guy has short hair, short blonde hair, and a kind of rugged face. So Bond patches up the knife wound he has from the guy, puts on his jacket, And then everyone just assumes he's him for the rest of the scene.
That's right.
Because all white people look the same to Haitians.
Well, he gets the briefcase that had been was being held on to for room 325 or whatever it was.
Oh, yes, sir. Do you want us to still hold on to it for you? Because apparently, again, they all think he's that guy. He's all Haitians. I mean, it's fair. It's fair.
It is. I mean, after Haiti was treated so poorly in Live and Let Die, I mean, or was that Jamaica?
This is also like hotel workers. Anywhere else in the world, they don't give a shit.
Yeah, no, they don't. You want the shit? I'm not holding it.
I don't care. Get out of here. Yeah, we're trying to go home.
And then a woman swings by and picks him up and goes, you don't look like any geologist I've ever seen before because I'm so rugged.
What was up with the timing sexy of that? Geologist. Was she literally like waiting around the block for a man carrying a briefcase?
I think she was waiting for the guy that Bond killed, theoretically, right? Because her boyfriend, or Dominique Green, had sent someone to kill her, right?
Yeah, right. It was that guy.
Yeah, it was that guy.
Killed. But I'm just wondering, because like immediately after Bond walks out, she's just kind of there and tells him to get in the car. It's like, was she waiting for him?
I assumed so.
No, she should have been waiting at the curb for someone. Right? Yeah. Like, that's what. But yes, you're right. She shows up like she's another MI6 agent, and Bond kind of responds as though she's another, like, a contact or something. But one way or another.
Let me see your rabbit's foot.
Right? Mission Impossible 2? No, which is the one with Philip Seymour Hoffman?
Oh, that's three.
That's three. Do you have the rabbit's foot? I'm just like, stop looking like you're going to rape me.
It's Philip Seymour Hoffman. That's just how he tended to look.
You know what? You're right. Even Brent from Big Lebowski or the moist-looking guy from Twister. He was the only one in his car. Like, he was...
Yeah. If I recall Twister, he would go on and on about the suck zone, and after a while, it just became very uncomfortable.
He just played porn a lot in his own van, didn't he? Just to himself, like the soundtrack?
Mm-hmm. That explains gross Boogie
man.
Nights.
Just a very gross man. But he was good in Boogie Nights.
He was. Yeah. He was a good actor. Rest in peace.
Yeah, R.I.P.D. Another Hoffman just... gone too soon.
So we're in Haiti, I think.
Yeah, and Bond opens the briefcase, and she goes, "What do you have for me?" And it's a file, and it lists her name, and she's surprised. Bond goes, "Someone wants you dead," and holds up a picture of her and a gun, effectively. Yep. So she kicks him out of the car. He kills the person who's trailing them.
Well, it's the best Roger Moore moment of the movie because he gets thrown out of the car and this guy on a motorcycle comes up behind him. It's like, you were supposed to shoot her. And he's like, well, I missed. And then he just judo chops the motorcycle. It flies through the air. He flies off and he just gets on that motorcycle.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, again, I mean, you're right. This is very Live and Let Die, which is kind of fun. But again, it's as though Daniel Craig has never heard of humor before. And I know, I'm sure he's a charming person, but in these movies, he doesn't smile.
He's too damn serious to smile.
Yeah.
I really think it would discredit his character if he smiled. He's not that kind of Bond.
I almost do. I mean, the closest he gets to smiling is at the end when he leaves Dominique in the desert.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And he's just like, I promised I'd leave you alive. And he just wanders off like, that's it. Regardless.
Oh, spoilers, by the way, just then.
Oh, yeah. You know, if you haven't seen a 9-year-old movie, whatever.
Yeah, spoilers. The bad guy dies.
Yeah, anyway. this is literally one you should listen. Well, I'd say us, but I'm sure there's a nostalgia critic that's only 20 minutes long. We're already at 20 minutes, so you're fine. But, yeah, this is rough. Mm. However, at this point, they get to this kind of loading dock on the, whatever. And Bond watches the woman walk in, who we really haven't been introduced to yet, other than that she is someone who's going to be around for a while.
Right. A while, in quotations.
Quote, quote. And she leaves and comes back a couple times. But Bond, it gets this note that, he essentially gives a card to a guy at the door. And he says, give the girl this card for me. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time that...
Oh, right. That whole bit at that warehouse area where she goes in through a lock gate and there's an armed guard there.
And he kind of watches her. This is where Dominique says, I was going to kill you. Would you like to see what I have? And then there's the general and all that stuff.
Yeah.
This is also where Bond introduces the Universal Exports for the first time as Daniel Craig, the cover operation that MI6 has. So for you nerds out there, we have Univex. And Bond gets the phone call. Whatever. Her plot is literally Robin's plot from Batman Forever. There's Boo. Someone that... But that's what it is.
Boo is right.
There's someone who murdered her family, so she became a superhero, and Bond says, don't kill her. Be careful, because when you kill someone you really hate, don't look at their eyes, etc., 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 and then she kills them at the end of the movie.
She's out for revenge, but she's not the protagonist.
But how do we know he's a bad guy? He's literally trying to rape someone when the entire hotel catches fire.
Yeah.
He's literally the most stereotypical bad guy of the early 2000s.
Where's everyone going? There's so much raping to do.
Can you serve me my beer in my room? And then screams coming from his room. It's like, it's not even subtle. It's the worst thing.
Yeah.
Gross.
He was taking her on making sure she had a very nice honeymoon.
God damn it. Thank you, Daniel. Advance the plot for me, buddy. I need a drink of beer.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's at this part where M realizes that Bond's killed all of these witnesses, so in order to prevent his movement, she cancels his passport and freezes his credit cards, and he realizes what she's doing, so he tells, like, the hotel clerk, oh, I'm going to Cairo, you're about to get a phone call in a second, after he tries to check in with his canceled credit card, and he ends up in Italy, which is where Dominic Green is, and they're attending, I'm not going to pronounce this right, Tosca, the opera.
Tosca, yeah. Now, we're going to skip over a lot of these action sequences because there's a lot for no reason. Like, there's a boat sequence, there's a running through a city sequence, because they literally all feel the same. They're all in fast motion. Bond kind of saves the woman to no avail because she runs off. We don't see her again for another half an act.
Well, there's that weird scene during the opera where it's apparently a conference call with Green and everybody else, and Bond's
listening. Oh, no, we should get into this. Okay, so... what we have is this sequence where Bond goes to the opera. He knows where Dominique Green is going. He figures it's a big deal. And then he's kind of watching Dominique Green from various weird angles and notices that he's going to a special little table and that everyone going to that table is getting a weird black gift bag like you're going to an Oscar party or something. Okay. And so he sees someone who's supposed to be going there but then pulls off to go to the bathroom. He kills the man in the bathroom and steals his little bag so he can get what they have. And it is an earpiece. So he's listening into whatever the secret group is, who apparently has people everywhere, and they're talking about blank.
Now, this is Quantum, right? This is the secret group.
This is Quantum. This
but they don't name Quantum until the last, God, 15 minutes of this 105-minute movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right. It is Quantum. And he even has a little Q pin, as though that's a temptation. I did think for a second it would be fun if Q had his own secret organization that he was only being leased by MI6.
Oh.
And the reason he hadn't shown up yet is that they stopped paying him enough, so he went rogue. It's like Krieger and Archer. Like, it's like Krieger at one point making super soldiers on the side, right? Yeah. Now, that being said, Quantum, we get the Q pin, which no one is wearing, which is weird. But yeah, we have this kind of modern Tosca opera. You made a point. This is very much like The Spy Who Loved Me when they're doing that opera.
That light show at the Great Pyramids of Giza.
Yeah, and that's kind of what it is. Like, this movie actually makes allusions to other Bond movies because, you know, it's kind of like now watching The Simpsons where everyone grew up watching The Simpsons, so they're making references to other episodes constantly. And, I mean, the next one, Skyfall, is the one where everyone really faults them for the fact that it's like a ripoff of every other Bond movie ever.
Well, that made sense, though, in Skyfall's case, because it was the 50th anniversary, so you've got to do a big blowout celebration about the fact that we've lasted 50 years.
Well, and I guess to wit, Adele really does sing kind of like that old, like, lounge style of Skyfall. And it's like, I mean, and she deserves the Academy Award for it. Why not? Because, you know, Frozen 2 was garbage. And
no, she did fine. She did fine.
Steve, you go, buddy. I'm going to just keep saying bullshit. I do like how Bond, like, dumps out the gift bag and there's, like, other shit. There's, like, a cell phone and a tablet and all this other stuff. He just throws it all away and just takes the earpiece.
He knows where the money's at. He's got a... Yeah. Some kind of spy training, apparently, to immediately, you know, he just, like, flips a switch and he can just see, oh, what's the glowing red thing? Let's just take that out of the bag, dump the rest of this shit, and I can listen in on this sweet quantum conversation.
Now, I know at the end of the opera, they're talking about the upcoming Bolivian coup, and Bond chimes in, at which point they try and kill him, but he throws one of the guards off the roof, and then they just shoot him because he's actually... That guard isn't supposed to see Dominic Green or something?
Yeah, it's kind of a weird scene. So Bond has the earpiece, and it's, you know, a two-way earpiece, and so everyone's kind of whispering so that they can kind of talk in this loud opera, and it's the kind of hiding in plain sight kind of thing where all these people who wouldn't meet, but they're all of the upper echelons of society, so they should be at a fancy opera somewhere in Italy, right?
Yeah.
And Bond chimes in and goes... You know, this is a very interesting conversation. And so all the bad guys stand up, except for Mr. White, who knows better.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bond starts taking their pictures, and then MI6 identifies a bunch of them. And turns out that one of the guys is an advisor to the prime minister or something like that.
Yeah, that's right.
And
there was another guy, member of, like, Special Branch or something, and that's who Bond killed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, who was, like, a bodyguard of his.
Yeah.
And Bond throws him off the roof, but doesn't see the fact that he gets shot. And so Bond gets blamed for another murder, which ends up being a big deal, right? I kind of find that part of Bond charming. This is him being a rapscallion, being like, hello, everyone. Hello, hello. Mr. White's just like, bad show anyway, and throws away the earpiece because he's played this game before, which apparently no one else knew what was going on. But at this point, we end up with the game is afoot. Bond realizes that he's a bad guy. They're kind of associating their fight. Bond shoots a bunch of people in a restaurant, which freaks them the hell out.
Right as the opera's playing over it, so there's no dialogue or gunshot sounds or anything. It was actually pretty cool, not gonna lie.
This is one of those scenes I think was very well directed.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got the director finding Neverland shooting an action scene. Of course it's going to be well directed.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Because that movie's known for its, you know, action sequences.
I'm surprised Johnny Depp didn't show up. Just help.
How did you feel about these action sequences, though? They were well choreographed. They were interesting, but I didn't think they added anything to the movie.
They're not my favorite, but I'm glad that they at least made the attempt to do them because they realized, oh, well, it's the shortest Bond movie ever. Mm-hmm. Our plot's... not the best. Our villain's not the most engaging. We should at least give the audience something.
I just wish it wasn't shaky cam everywhere. You know, I mean, honestly, I appreciated it. And
now, was shaky cam really worse than the slide whistle in Man with a Golden Gun?
I was going to ask you guys which one you hated more, shaky cam or found footage movies.
Well, is there a difference half the time?
No, you're right. No. I made that note and I realized it was a stupid question because... one inherently has action and one doesn't, but God, this movie is unwatchable at times. And even the action sequences, which you said, are interesting and they're fun. It's just, ugh. I want to see who Bond is actually punching sometimes, right?
Yeah, I want to see who Bond actually is in this movie. He's Rambo. He's Rambo, actually.
Well, he's always been Rambo.
He's especially Rambo.
Rambo with a drinking problem, really.
Yeah. Well, he's Rambo with a drinking problem, but he's not clever enough to be Rambo with a drinking problem.
Well, I guess he was still the young Bond, though, at this time, because Casino Royale was meant to be like a reboot, like Batman Begins, so this is still inexperienced Bond.
Well, I mean, and to your point, this is when we're introduced to Mathis, who is the one humanizing part of this movie, right? Bond shows up in his villa where he says, look, I was wrong, effectively, you were not... at all responsible for what happened in Casino Royale.
Oh, and I was wrong. This is, he meets Mathis after M freezes his credit cards, not before the opera bit. So right. That was my bad.
You're fine. But he shows up at this villa, and Mathis is there with his wife and goes, you know, look, you betrayed me. And he goes, yeah. And his wife goes, yeah, but that bought you this house, so that's okay.
And then he suggests that she go work on her tan, and she's just out of the movie.
Yeah, she's gone.
Yeah, she was gone. That's fine.
This is really the first Bond character in like 40 years that I would expect her to be dismissed by Bond just saying, man talk.
Yeah, man talk. This is essentially a man talk scene.
Yeah.
And she goes, you don't serve good wine to a guy who had me arrested. And he goes, you only buy cheap wine. She got a quip. That was a good quip. She did. But essentially, Bond needs a new passport and new credit because, like you said, all of his credit has been frozen. And I don't know. This is kind of this... I find the Mathis scenes charming because he's one of the few things that hold Bond to humanity, right? The only problem is that is often done by saying, so you seem to miss Vesper. Vesper wasn't your fault. Vesper, 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 Vesper.
Suicide, Vesper, Vesper.
My precious Vesper.
Yeah.
Poor lady.
And so Bond says, look, you don't have to help me. I'd appreciate if you did. And then he goes, well, you don't have to come with me. And, of course, that's when we find that he's not only helping him, but he is coming with him along on this mission.
Yes.
At which point they're kind of on the deck, or on the in first class at a 770, or 787, something like that, 777. Mm-hmm. And they're having drinks, right? And, in fact, for those of you who are Bond nerds, Bond is ordering the drink, the Vesper, that he invented in the previous movie.
Six times, apparently, is how much the bartender said.
Yeah, and he's offering one to Mathis. And Mathis goes, no, it would keep me awake. Do you need anything to help you sleep? I have uppers, downers, reds, blues.
A whole trunk full of uppers, downers.
I don't know. And this is, again, where he's like, don't feel bad about Vesper. I'm an important guardian angel figure. Help, 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 help. I don't know. It's a really shitty scene.
Remember Vesper? She was a babe, but don't feel bad. Do you feel better now?
I do. when they land, Bond is intercepted by a woman named Fields, who's from the embassy.
According to the wiki, her name is Strawberry Fields.
Of course she is.
Is it really?
According to the wiki, yes.
Of course. That's appropriate.
Is that in like her IMDb, like in her credits, or because like I think at one point Bond goes, "Do you have a first name?" She goes, "No, just Fields." Fields.
Yes,
that's the stupidest thing ever.
We were just talking about silly Beatles songs. It's perfect.
We were. Yeah.
Well, this is decidedly not Strawberry Fields forever. Though.
That's a shame.
Spoilers award alert.
Award, the Spoilers
Award. Spoilers Awards.
We should give out the Spoilers Award.
That sounds like something at the Razzies.
Yeah, please.
The Spoilers Award goes to the trailer that gave away the most in the trailer. That's stupid. I'm done. Anyway.
Well, they're back in Bolivia now, which is apparently where Green was staging the coup, and Bond heard about it on that conversation, so he decides, I better go check that out.
Yeah. So, effectively, Bond... you know, gets this invitation, right? Like he has sex with Fields, and then he gets
that was the weirdest like a bit of
nothing.
He didn't even try. Like,
yeah, she goes, "Where's the stationery?" And she laughs, and then they're having sex.
Yes.
And then Mathis shows up with an invitation. He goes, "This is where you're going to want to be. This is where Dominique Green is giving a speech." And she goes, I haven't a thing to wear. And then he makes out with her, and that's the end of that. Then we end up with this speech at the ruins.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Something about how terrible it is that, 17% of the vegetated area on the planet's gone or something.
Yeah, and it's about him trying to save the water. He's making argument right. that he's saving water, and this is when the idea of water instead of oil is being introduced. Mm-hmm.
And then immediately after that, somebody who heard the speech and was moved wanted to give him a grant, but his girlfriend, who we were introduced, talks the person out of it.
Does anyone remember her name?
I know I can't pronounce the actress's name. Camille Montes.
That's the character.
Yeah. Oh, the actresses?
Olga
Kurlyankova-Somovic.
Yeah, there you go. Olga, Russian name, is playing a character named Camille, and Camille's the one who keeps showing back up. Mm-hmm. And she shows up very drunk mm-hmm. and about a head taller than Dominique Green. And
because saying, Dominique Green is Roman Polanski.
Yeah. I thought you just bought up all that land with the water on it. And he goes, shut up, woman, and is threatening to throw her off the third story when Bond throws up.
Yeah. Bond shows up, not throws up. That's in between scenes.
That was Casino Royale when he throws up.
Yes.
And that's when Bond... No, that's when Fields trips his little number two toady guy down the stairs and his wig falls off for some reason.
Yep. Because why not?
What a stupid scene. Christ, that scene is in this movie. Whatever. And I think his number two is named Elvis. Did I make that up?
It's in
my notes. Okay, this is when we need to talk about someone else who's awesome, but not in this movie enough, and that's Felix Leiter.
Yeah, he was in this movie, wasn't he?
Right. Okay, so Jeffrey Wright is back as Felix Leiter.
Well, what was the whole thing? Like, Dominic Green was telling the CIA, basically, to the guy named Mr. Beam, who's, like, the head of South American operations. Oh, by the way, I'm staging a coup in Bolivia. Just a heads up, fellas. And Mr. Beam's like, okay. And Felix is there going, I don't think that's okay.
Right. And Dominic Green gets pinged by MI6, and they call the CIA, and the CIA is like, it's not a big deal. And M's like, it's a big deal. And you're just like, whackity shmackity do. It's so stupid. And the bad guy looks like a bad guy from, God, any of the CIA movies, like from Argo. He looks like a bad guy from Phillips War, the Tom Hanks movie.
Oh, Captain Phillips?
No. The one where he's the guy who's funding the Mujahideen.
Oh, Charlie Wilson's War.
Charlie Wilson's War. You know, just a mustachioed CIA guy who's just the bad guy, kinda. That's what he looks like. And then there's Jeffrey Wright just scowling the whole time. And you're just like, Jeffrey Wright gets it.
Yeah.
You know, Felix, I don't think you're as passive as you think you are. And he goes, James, you have 30 seconds to get out of here before they show up. 10 seconds. Bond, go. And he just gives him all the information. Felix is awesome. He's in like 4 scenes and he has 3 lines, but he nails it. I like him. And now he's gone forever. Unfortunately, he needs to be in more of these movies.
Yes, he does. Although Felix was gone for a while in the Pierce Brosnan era too. So.
Well, he was gone because at the end of the Tim Dalton movies, he got his legs beaten off by a shark.
Yes.
That's why we have Jodan Baker.
This is why Eva Lair's wheelchair accessible now.
Oh, before we got to Bolivia, did we get to Mathis's death scene, or did that happen in Bolivia?
That happens. That's the next scene.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Because after Bond drives away, right? He drives away from the dinner or whatever after saving Camille, right? Mm-hmm. And he gets pulled over by the cops. And the cops say, open your trunk, and that's where Mathis is. And so Bond beats up the cops.
Mm-hmm. And who put Mathis there? Or did Mathis just climb in there and decide, this is a good spot?
He tied himself up. It was
okay, so I have a theory because it's not well explained in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's introducing Bond to a colonel. And it turns out that the colonel is on Green's payroll. So I think the colonel turned him into the police force, and they were the ones who beat up and killed Mathis. I think that's what we're supposed to believe.
Okay.
But then we have actually a pretty rough death scene.
Oh, yeah.
This is actually one of the
Another one.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
Oh, no, there's just a lot. There are several of these, in fact. I mean, we were talking about this being sort of a darker film, and it really is. There's some pretty brutal, you know... This is kind of a stark contrast, again, from the Roger Moore, where it's very kind of matter-of-fact, outsmarting. You brought the point, he's kind of, Daniel Craig is kind of behind the eight ball all the time, and it really does feel that way. He's always playing catch-up. He's always kind of beating people because of a little bit of luck. He's a badass, but it's like a little bit of luck there. Roger Moore was always ahead of the eight ball. Like, right, people were, he was manipulating people to do things that he wanted to do, and that's how he got the upper hand, and it...
And he knew shit. Like,
he knew everything.
He just knew lepidoptery. He knew dumb things.
Yeah, of course. I know dental history, and that's going to help me right now, because why the fuck not?
Yeah, but here Mathis gets this kind of line where, he didn't need to come out of retirement. He didn't need to help Bond. He chose to help Bond. And in some ways, it's interesting because, he fell in love with Vesper, and then Vesper betrayed him before essentially killing herself. And now you have someone who's willing to help him solve what happened, who is dying. And, you literally see Bond losing what's left of his humanness, his humanity, as Mathis asks him to hold him while he's dying, which is not only heartbreaking, but Bond does it and then throws him in a dumpster.
Right where he belongs.
And then Camille goes, is this how you treat your friends? And he goes, Mathis would have wanted it this way. Takes the cash out of his wallet and then moves on. It's rough. It really is. And again, it's one of the few scenes that a lot of this movie you could edit out. This scene is one of the ones you'd keep in because it feels like it matters, and it's very bleak on humanity and everything.
Plus, it's one of the few times a Bond character gets closure. Mathis was introduced in Casino Royale, and he was a big new character, and then they bring him back, and they actually build on him.
Well, and it's also one of the times when someone sees Bond weak, right? Because, watching The Spy Who Loved Me recently, she goes, I remember, he's meeting the Russian spy, and she's listing all these things, and she goes, you've lost one wife.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, we don't talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's what, and that's at one point something Dominique Green says. You're like, so you, did you lose another one? Sounds like you've lost another one. Mm-hmm. And it's just Bond's just some, it's just something he can't grasp, which is great. Someone has information on Bond that makes him human, and we don't get that a lot, especially with Daniel Craig, who seems to be like the Punisher in some French movie, just murdering people. Which, if you've seen the two Punisher movies that came out recently, that's kind of how they are.
Yeah.
Oh,
check out the second one, Punisher Warzone. It's fantastic.
Yeah, who directed that? Do you remember? French woman.
It was a German woman.
German woman.
Lila or Lola something?
But it is a bloodbath. It's fantastic.
No, it is.
At this point, Mathis is Shakespearean death, as I put it. We see Bond literally lose any emotion from his face for the rest of it. And so he and Camille head back. At this point they head out to the desert. Mm-hmm. Because they have a lot of going to the desert, coming back, going to the desert, coming back. So I'm going to try to keep this straight and I'm going to get it wrong. But I'm trying, damn it. They end up in an airstrip in reference to Dominic said. They rent a plane, which Bond says, you know, he's going to turn us in, whatever. There's a weird... like 1940, it's an Indiana Jones fight.
Yeah,
they even
really
rent the plane from a guy in a leather jacket and a fedora, and I'm just like, it's South American Indiana Jones is my notes, but whatever.
They gave him some gold coins. They took the plane.
Yeah. Well, he used the car as collateral, but the guy wanted
Camille.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, she acknowledges that she's working for Bolivian intelligence. They end up destroying the two planes, but are too damaged after a stall. They crash in a scene that would have killed Bond when they parachute. And they pull the cord at like 5 feet from the ground.
They fall into a sinkhole, right? And only Camille has a parachute, and Bond's like desperately trying to grab onto her before she pulls the cord.
And that's when we discover that it's not about oil, and all this pipeline is for water.
Water. That's right.
We see this reservoir, and it's... this is when it becomes, for about 10 minutes, a documentary. Like, a bleak... because you see a bunch of people dressed in traditional Bolivian garb trying to open the spigot and get water, and nothing's coming out. Mm-hmm. We even have this weird kind of, like, fantasy shot of them in, like, ghostly projections, and they're split up into three different walking shots as they walk through, you know, the waves of heat. Then they take a bus, and then they go back to a 9-star hotel, which no one could ever afford.
Yeah.
And at that point, they receive the message from the front desk that just says, run.
Yeah.
And Bond chooses not to run.
Of course not. He's never been one to listen to advice.
From someone that was trying to literally warn him that M was in his room rifling through his personals.
And that Strawberry Fields is up there, too, having been drowned in crude oil.
Yes. Which, again, is literally a scene out of Goldfinger.
Yep. Yeah, that's right.
My note right before Strawberry Fields and Oil was, is this the live-action Tailspin movie?
Yes.
It is.
It is.
Look, we already mentioned Jaws. We had to mention Oddjob, right? Like, we had to bring it home.
Just like a giant biplane. Because these are propeller planes fighting each other, too. It's just so stupid. And that's when Bond finds out that, you know, Dominique Green is like, it's not oil. And this is when everyone wants to get him, because at this point we have a CIA guy who's dead. Mathis is dead, so the French are after him. M is fighting everyone off, and we find out that it's all about water. Yeah, I mean, that's all.
That's pretty much it. We find the plot, and then I think it was around this time where I decided I should pause the movie and just take a nice 20-minute nap, which was glorious.
Well, I mean...
glorious reprieve.
I was going to watch it in two bits. I ended up watching it. It's not a very long movie. No. At this point, Bond, sick of M and sick of the whole thing. M actually puts him under arrest at this point, right? And says, you go back to London. Bond beats up all the other guards in an elevator, walks away, and... essentially tells M what he's going to do. Mm-hmm. And M's like, just don't get caught, effectively. And he goes to... he goes to a phone booth, calls Felix, and the CIA guy's like, you should investigate what he's saying. And they meet in this bar, and this is where we have that scene where he's like, look, go out to this one hotel in the middle of the desert. That's where he's going to be. That's where the handoff is literally happening right now for that water.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, Felix, I think you're more of a person than you pretend to be. And he goes, yeah.
And then the SWAT, in that tone of voice, too.
Pretty much. He goes, you got 2 seconds, Bond. And he just finishes his spear while the SWAT team is shooting everywhere. Like, whatever.
Yeah. He's Felix Leiter.
Felix is a badass in this movie that I wish we spent more time with.
Yeah.
Because it seems like his movie has spent a lot of time, like, because I think Bond actually answers the phone going, you know, Felix, you should just put CIA in the phone book. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. I thought it was great.
He is. He's one of those off characters that you really wish, if there was a spinoff, let's see what this dude's been up to the whole movie.
And Jeffrey Wright is good at it, man. Yeah,
totally.
I mean, Then essentially we're introduced back to all the main characters that are left alive, except for Felix, who's gone. But the general who Camille wants to kill is back. We have Dominique back, and they're doing the exchange. Essentially, Dominique is using the money of Quantum to fund his coup so mm-hmm. that he can be in charge of Bolivia and that Quantum can make money off of everything. Okay? Right. And I know Dan hates CinemaSins.
Not the biggest fan.
But the guy literally pulls up one of the cliches that CinemaSins always points out, which is that he comes out of the helicopter, Dominique Green pulls out of the helicopter eating an apple to show what an asshole he is, which is something that the CinemaSins points out every time, which is that, and he's eating an asshole because he... Or eating, this isn't a German film. He's eating an apple to prove what an asshole he is. Which is in my notes. Eating an apple makes you an asshole.
Let me see those notes. I think you might have it the other way. Oh, yeah.
And then we enter a Godfather 3 room, which is a room on the top floor with a round table that everyone's sitting around with a giant window on the roof, which is about to explode or something. At which point, he signs away the land that Dominic Green was promised.
Yep.
After saying, send the beer to my room, which is going to turn into a rape scene, of course.
Of course.
And, Yeah, guys, we're running out of movie. This is...
No, seriously, it sounds like we're still in the second act and the big fight with the baddies coming. It's not.
Here, I mean, frankly, and we'll get to this at the end, I'm sure, but the problem is that there's so much plot crammed into a movie that not a lot happens in, and so we're spending more time talking about what happens next because it makes no sense that they're back in the desert for the third time.
Well, I just kept thinking, this is supposed to be the follow-up to Casino Royale. When are we going to get to all those hanging threads? I mean, Mr. White's still out there.
Well, and again, Casino Royale is interesting because it's essentially like... The whole thing is the chamber drama of him saying, here's what I'm going to do. And they're playing cards the whole time. And in a movie that's like 2 hours and 15 minutes long, they're playing cards for 45 minutes, almost an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And it's dramatic. Like, mm-hmm. it matters. Bond is poisoned. It has to tighten his tie and come back in. And like, that's awesome. The fourth act of the movie makes no sense. But the rest of it is really tight and fantastic. This one just... Mm-hmm. God, it's plot heavy for such a short movie. It's an hour and it's 105 minutes.
Hour 45.
It's just oh my God. It felt like everything needed to happen. Regardless, again, I have two pages of notes in my field notes still.
So we just got through the Godfather 3 bit with the helicopter.
And essentially what shows up is this is when the general goes, I won't sign this document. He goes, look. We've dealt with your predecessor. He didn't want to pay either, and now you're in charge. There'll be someone after you grasping. Mm-hmm. You either pay the triple we want for your utilities, or you're dead.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And that's kind of...
It was like the License to Kill scene. You're only president for life.
Right. That's exactly what it is. It's fine. And it looks like General Tapioca out of a Tintin book, which is for it's for John Copsey, who's not here. But, you know, like, it's such a stereotypical Latin American dictator, and then there's a guy behind him with a beard and a gun, and that's all he does.
He's the enforcer, man.
Right. And then Elvis is there with just documents and a folio, and it's fantastic. Whatever. At this point, Bond shows up at the hotel with his Land Rover in the basement. Camille is already there with the intention of killing the general. After documents are signed, he's DTF, and we're going to end up with a rape scene, apparently, which we hear off camera.
Is this when he tries to go back and Camille's in the room?
Well, at first the waitress is in the room, and then she shoots his two guards and goes into the room, and that's when there's that fight scene there. Bond's, unfortunately, because he can't not destroy everything, he reminds me... After a growth spurt when I was a teenager, and he just walks into a room and everyone's dead and exploding. Because, like, there starts at, like, he drives his car into the garage, shoots a guy, explodes a hydrogen fuel cell, and that immediately starts the explosion of everything.
Explosions work, folks.
Totally.
That was a reference to myopia panelist who's not here, Michael Krause, who reminded me that when I came over when I was a kid, I would knock everything off of everything. Yeah. And so Bond, what? Well, I mean, there's a fight scene throughout a burning hotel as he... God, okay, I can't... Of all the movies to be thinking of right now, we go from watching The Dark Knight, which is Casino Royale and the beginning of this movie, to Batman and Batman Forever, a Schumacher movie. Because after Camille kills the general...
Yeah.
She's sitting there crying in the corner as Bond literally rescues her from a hellscape. Yeah. As the whole... Okay, I wrote this in my notes. This is a bleak fucking scene.
It sure is.
He has a handgun.
Yeah.
And he has shot the guards, and there's presumably at least one bullet left, right? And she is weeping in the corner, inconsolable,
after unable to move. Killing the guy that
raped and murdered her family, presumably. Unable to move, and he pulls out the gun and starts to aim it towards her, right? Like, he's about to fucking kill her, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All of a sudden, this turns into a very much like, she's gonna slow me down, not be able to get out, I have to end her, until he sees the exposed fuel cell on the wall, which he can hopefully get an escape out of, right? Because there's really a moment there where he's going
to
fucking...
Well, I guess what they were trying to do is, the whole thing is that Bond's out of control in this movie, even though that's never really proven. M just keeps saying it, and this is him trying to say, oh, no, wait, I'm actually a good guy.
I will say, though, we'll get to his rampage, which is, I guess it's technically the epilogue, but feels more like the 5-second long third act of this movie, which is awesome.
Yeah.
It's kind of, I mean, it is kind of the best scene in some ways. I put the Mathis scene at the top, but it's right there, man. It's Bond fucking doing it. But whatever. So, they blow out the sidewall.
Yep. They escape, and Green, he's captured Green too, right?
He captures Green, he ends up in the back of the car, and he goes, look, I've told you everything I want you wanted to know. I get to go free. And he goes, I'll let you go free. He tosses him a can of oil. And then just abandons him in the Bolivian desert.
That was the one scene from this movie I remember, because it was sort of Bond just going, hello, Green, I'd like to play a game.
Yes. I mean, and it's... This is theoretically the end of his rampage, because the next movie doesn't pick up any of these pieces.
No.
There's no catharsis at the end until the next scene, which is amazing.
Oh, yes.
Did you have a note, Steve? I'm sorry. Daniel and I get to talking.
No. Please continue with the. I mean,
well, the way Green actually gets finished off before we go into this final scene where they tie up the biggest loose end, and I think this is the one Bond film where they don't show the villain die on screen.
We get alluded to it.
We get a report later. Yeah.
He gets found in the desert with two bullets in the back of his head, which didn't come from Bond, and his stomach contained motor oil, which Bond tries to deny knowing anything about.
Yeah. Which is great. I mean, it's neat, and it's so often, like, for example, with Goldfinger, I'm sure that one resort got a whole bump from being... The hotel they filmed in, it's a beautiful resort. I'm sure that hotel really exists, the plaza, whatever, in the middle of the desert. I wonder if people are like, hello, did you burn down? Like,
yeah. You know,
it's nothing.
The Bavarian Desert Hotel.
Oh, fuck. Whatever. And so all of a sudden, you think the movie's over. Green has been abandoned in the desert, and if this was any other movie, if it wasn't the Rampage movie we were expecting, this would be a cold cut, and then we'd get the final kick song. Well, the kick line version of the Jack White song that we whatever. However, we end up in Siberia, because one of the things that M presents him with at the beginning of the movie is pictures of Vesper's boyfriend, who actually apparently had connections to this organized crime organization, right? And so we end up in Siberia, where he is coming back from a date, and not unlike Die Another Day or Goldfinger? Or no, Dr. No. Bond is playing solitaire with himself with a gun out, drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And he comes in the door. Him and the woman sit down on the couch, and he goes, you're Canadian intelligence. You have 2 seconds to just leave. Just go. And she leaves. And, And then Bond just freaking kills the guy.
Well, the woman also had the same necklace Vesper had in Casino Royale, and Bond still has that necklace. So he's, like, showing it to her just to say, this guy, you know, he doesn't care about you. He's using you. So.
He's using you. At that point, we cut to outside where Bond drops the necklace, you know.
And tells Bond to come back because she needs him, even though she spent the entire movie complaining about him.
Well, he never left, so.
Yes, he never left. And I think that's the movie right there, isn't it? He drops Vesper's necklace in the snow, and yeah.
Well, I mean, and isn't that... And essentially, you know, M goes, you know, this wasn't personal, was it? And he goes, no, of course not. That would be unprofessional.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, and he drops the thing in the sand, in the snow. You know, Felix gets promoted to section chief.
He replaces Mr. Jim Beam.
Yeah, Jim Beam. Such a stupid freaking thing. Yeah, and all the, I guess, accusations against Bond go away.
Magically.
Yeah, I mean...
These are the perks when you're in a spy organization, right?
But here's the thing, like, if we're... I think making it so gritty makes it more awkward, because I'm like, yeah, totally the CIA would cover up this bullshit, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, that's the problem in the 70s. You're just kind of like, oh, everyone's just so charming.
Yeah.
Have you heard of kombucha? It's new. Like, you know, like... you know, like, the idea that here he's just getting hammered off of Vespers and Heineken, you're just like, who could possibly care, right?
Yeah, this was a weird, weird approach that they took.
Well, it's the shaky cam. It's just weird.
It just doesn't work. I mean, they were using shaky cam in Casino Royale for some scenes, but it worked because we were invested in the characters. And here it's just like, oh, people like shaky cam now. We better use it. And they just ignored everything else.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I'll mention before we get really to the end and some thoughts is this is when it ends. That's when we finally get the da-da-dun-da-da-da.
Oh, yeah, the gun barrel scene.
Which we hadn't gotten in either of the first two movies, right? Yeah, this is the first one we got, and this is actually Daniel Craig is now James Bond. He's hardened, he's unfeeling, he's killed some people, and he's settled his personal business. He is now Bond, right?
Finally, all the loose ends have been tied up. We have a James Bond, folks.
And we'll get to Skyfall next, where we have a Scottish Home Alone movie.
And James Bond versus the Joker, which is what Skyfall really is.
Yeah. You mean because the Joker's in love with Batman?
Essentially.
Yeah. Or is that Spectre I'm thinking of? No, it is Skyfall.
Yeah.
I don't know, guys. What were your thoughts? What do you got for me?
I remember when this first came out, and people... After Casino Royale, I was like, yeah, Bond's good again. Finally, a new Bond film. And this came out, and everybody was just kind of angry in a lot of ways because it just is nowhere near as good as Casino Royale. They thought, oh, well, we've already rebooted the franchise. We don't even need to try with this one. And everyone's sort of like, you kind of do. So they didn't really go in with any engaging villains or a tight script or anything that really they try to approach what they did with Bond in Casino Royale and try to make him a character again, but then there was never any payoff. So it's just sort of a nothing movie, and it doesn't really work as even a gap between Casino Royale and Skyfall.
Yeah, it really does feel like they were trying to ride the coattails of success from Casino Royale. There was a management term that we used to use. It was a compliment sandwich. You guys heard of this? Yeah. So Skyfall and Casino Royale
are the compliments. Always just two slices of bread.
Yeah. So it's like, hey, you're doing a great job, but you're really just shit in the bed. But you're really doing a great job. And that's, you know, Quantum of Solace was the shit in the bed right in the middle of Skyfall and Casino Royale. And that's the way it felt. Like a movie on its own, you go back and watch it a decade later, it's okay. In terms of mediocre Bond movies, it's okay. But when you follow up Casino Royale or Skyfall with this movie, it feels really half-assed. And that's, you know, again, it felt like a Bourne Identity movie with Bond. There weren't a lot of gadgets. There weren't a lot of quips. There wasn't a lot of cleverness. But it had some great scenes. So, you know, if you're looking for a mediocre Bond film, this is a decent one.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to even figure it out because, like, the next one has a more interesting villain, of course, but and the previous one has a more interesting, but, like, in some ways, the previous one is on paper even worse because it's slow. It's a lot of plotting. And yet I cared when things happened. This there's so much shaking and nothing seems to matter. Like, literally nothing seems to matter. It's just shaky cam, and Bond should never be in shaky cam.
Yeah.
Honestly, like, Sean Connery is like, you can see the there's ninjas in Sean Connery movies, and it's slower than this.
It feels unprofessional. Like, Bond is the epitome of methodical and shaky cam is just not that. It's very much like, oh, Blair Witch, like, we just found a camera on the ground. Let's follow Bond around while he kicks some ass. That's not...
Well, and I mean, and to point, if it's supposed to be Casino Royale Part 2, it should be filmed like Casino Royale was. Yeah. And it's just not. It feels... I mean, and I know I'm an old man, and so, like, halfway through a glass of whiskey, I was watching that Bond movie, and I was just like, am I going to be sick? I'm already sitting down. I can't sit down more. But it's just... Other than a few scenes which really humanize them, it feels like they almost wanted to do another hour to the end of Casino Royale, but they couldn't, so they made another movie made up of 45 minutes of more bullshit.
That's what they did.
They had a Bond spec script from somebody, and they're like, oh, okay, we'll just use that. We won't even address anything that happened in Casino Royale until the very end.
I mean, and that's kind of how it feels. Like, it feels as though, like, it's like Majora's Mask compared to Ocarina of Time.
It is what it is. Like, you built a great engine. Why just throw that away? Like, we could just churn out 3 more movies that are the same movie and, you know, that's money.
Well, and that's, I mean, I guess to the point, it's why Skyfall and then Spectre took so many more years in between them to take some time and make a complex plot line. And I know some people hate Spectre and some people hate Skyfall, but I think overall they're more successful as individual films because they take that time to do it. Like, this one really does feel like we need another director because we don't have a contract with whatever, but we'll just make a sequel. Like, right away, a sequel, which, God, it's like watching Star Trek 2 than watching Star Trek 3. Like, Search for Spock just...
It makes you wonder if there was some weird contractual thing going on that forced the issue, but yeah, it felt a little... This one felt a little premature.
Yeah. Man. Where's someone from that 70s show making a supercut of the two of them together into 1 2.5-hour movie?
Yeah, man. It really could have been. Just put this...
I mean, just something, because it just feels so hacky. I mean, positives. There are some interesting scenes. There's some interesting ideas. Daniel Craig finally develops into a Bond that I like. And, I mean, all of them made bad movies, right?
Oh, sure.
But it's just, this one is such a letdown after such a good movie.
God, yeah.
And Jack White, come on.
Hey, the Aston Martin DBS is sweet, though. So they had
it was good,
for him.
Which we had for 6 seconds before he ends up in a VW Bug for half the movie.
Oh, the VW Bug.
It was a rental. Come on.
Right.
They couldn't have it all day.
Anyway, so that's it. I hope you guys are enjoying this because we only have 2 left, next to Skyfall, followed by Spectre. That means after this one comes out, obviously it's once a month, and starting next month, or actually starting later this month, Myopia Season 4 begins, so please tune in. We have some surprises down the pipeline, including a spinoff called Myopia Afternoon, which we won't tell you about quite yet. But tune in, I guess, by the next episode, when we will have another piece of your past on trial. But Mission Briefing itself will return next time, when Bond returns in Skyfall. Thanks, guys.
Ba-da-ba-da, da-da-da.
Mission Briefing and Myopia Defend Your Childhood are produced by Dude Letter Podcasting. It's hosted and edited by Nick Hoffman. Our graphic designer is Scott Miller. The theme song is sampled from Monty Norman's James Bond theme. Questions and comments? Please visit myopiapodcast.com/missionbriefing or contact us through myopiamissionbriefing@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter @missionbriefing and @myopiapodcast. And find us on Facebook, Stitcher, and iTunes. And while you're on iTunes, please rate and review our podcast. Want to help us out? Go to myopiapodcast.com/Amazon and purchase stuff like normal. Myopia and Mission Briefing get a piece of the action.
Another bill from a killer, turn a thriller to a tragedy. James Bond will return in Skyfall.